Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Is the world more peaceful since the revolution? It is a shame that your people suffered. But bounty hunting is a complicated profession.
Hello, and welcome to the last episode of Still Watching The Mandalorian Season 1. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I am special correspondent Anthony Bresnikan.
And we are here to talk about the season finale of The Mandalorian, Chapter 8, Redemption. And we're also, Anthony and I are also going to fulfill a promise we made on another podcast, Little Gold Men, to talk in a spoiler heavy. Spoiler heavy way about The Rise of Skywalker. So we're going to do that at the end of this episode. We're going to have a little segment where we talk about The Rise of Skywalker, like gloves off, spoilers galore. We're going to get into it. And we'll give you a warning when that's come if you still haven't seen the movie, but we're not going to spoil it. Probably too much. We might mention a thing or two in discussion of this finale as it relates to The Rise of Skywalker, but we're not going to get into it too much, but we'll save that for the segment at the end, and that's just us fulfilling our promise to you. If you want to hear our initial talk about The Rise of Skywalker, our early impressions, sort of a more in-depth discussion, you can listen to that over on the Little Gold Men feed. We did that episode in conjunction with a discussion of cats, so everything is everything you could ever want in a podcast over there. So this is it. This is the end. I am in London. I can see King's Cross train station from my window. Anthony is back in good old California.
Where it's
evening here, morning there. We're doing it, Anthony.
We're a transnational podcast today.
I love it. How bold of us. All right, so let us talk about this finale. I guess I just want to ask you, first of all, Anthony, if, you know, your general thoughts, like how, both on this finale and the season, like how did this finale land for you? And then how does it sort of tie a bow on the whole first season for you?
I thought it was a very good finale. It started in a shocking way for me, Baby Yoda getting slapped not once, but three times. Like, that was messed up. That was so wrong. What are we, I mean, we're not supposed to laugh at that, but he got when the stormtrooper whacked him and then whacked him again harder. I'm like, oh my God. Oh my God. I can't believe they just did that. And then the other stormtrooper slaps the bag that he's in. And I guess Baby Yoda is fine, but still that was, I know it's a puppet. That was bracing to see. The world loves Baby Yoda, and to see him mm-hmm. roughed up was kind of a shock. But it made you really hate those two douchebags, stormtroopers, voiced by Jason Sudeikis and Adam Pally,
who are experts at playing douchebags. So I love to I love those guys. Love to see them here. Adam Pally had been in a previous episode, but Sudeikis as like his partner was sort of,
well, he was in the previous episode as the same character, as one of those scout troopers chasing down Quill, aka I Have Spoken, who ain't speaking no more. He's deceased. Aww, poor guy.
He's for real dead. Yeah.
But so those two guys, I thought this was the most Taika Waititi scene of the Taika Waititi directed episode, where their banter back and forth and they're lingering. It takes a while for the stormtroopers to move because they're waiting for Moff Gideon, played by Giancarlo Esposito, to get done killing people out of anger who are on his side. And they're just sort of cooling their heels, slapping Baby Yoda around and
doing a little target practice.
Shooting, I don't know, what, some sort of like little canister that's not very far away, but neither one of them can seem to hit. And and that was kind of funny. And then IG-11 shows up and destroys them, like physically beats them to smithereens.
Which you're rooting for, because at this point you hate them because they've hit Baby Yoda. So you're like, yes, IG-11, kill those guys. It is a very Taika, moment. And think about is, you know, going back in time to mm-hmm. when, Phil Lord and Chris Miller were hired, to do, Solo mm-hmm. and how they were let go just because their vision wasn't really aligning with what Lucasfilm wanted to do or what the Kasdans wanted to do for that film. And the reports from the set was that, you know, Lord and Miller were doing like a very loose, improvisational, comedic, Star Wars, which is what you hire Lord and Miller to do, right? And, you know, as it turned out, Lucasfilm didn't want that. But like this, watching this scene, I was like, this makes me really wish I had seen Lord and Miller Solo. Honestly, mm-hmm. like I think it could have been really fun to see that. So
sure.
Yeah, because I like, there's a question, like, how much irreverence is too much in a Star Wars? You know, like, yes, Star Wars have always been, like, funny and a little irreverent. Han Solo, you know, says a bunch of stuff in the original trilogy that, you know, is very comedic. But this is a step further, and I think it's a step that works. And maybe The Mandalorian is the place to workshop that rather than a big feature film, one scene in an episode of The Mandalorian.
Yeah.
It's
tricky because Star Wars is inherently kind of absurd. You know, right. I saw a tweet that described it as like the story of a space zoo full of Muppets and people carrying around candy colored laser swords. And I was like, that's not inaccurate. It reminds me a little of like how Mark Hamill described working on the original Star Wars and saying like he was excited to get work, you know, but is this going to be good? Like I'm running through a space station with a giant space ape. And Alec Guinness and the space ape is the one who's going to fly us to safety. He's like, I don't know if this is going to be good for me or not. It turned out to be great. But like, there's an inherent like silliness to it. And so when you add comedy on top, it can quickly get into Spaceballs territory. And I think this just walked the line perfectly, as Rian Johnson did in the opening of The Last Jedi when
with Hux
and Poe and Poe's like it. Still waiting, you know. Hux, please, like that gag I thought worked too, even though it was overtly funny. It's good to have a little humor, but it's also like you don't want it to become a spoof, and I thought this was really funny without becoming, you know, remember that short film, was it called Troops? It was supposed to be like Cops.
Oh, we're right. Yeah.
Like one of the earliest fan films.
I've seen it. Yeah. It's a lot. So I mean, this is a Taika episode. Taika also gets to play, you know, at least his voice gets to play a large role in the episode. So what do you think is this is like the way that they decided to wrap up this season? The balance of tone or the questions answered or the things accomplished?
Well, after that opening sequence, it becomes pretty much like the tone shifts back to Mandalorian tone, just action, adventure, space western. They're pinned down. My wife pointed out that when they bring the E-Web heavy repeater, which is a toy that lots of kids had from back in the 80s, if you had the Hoth playset, you had the you didn't know what it was called, but it was that big black scary Gatlin laser mm-hmm. from Hoth. He sets that thing up, and my wife was like, oh, this is like Young Guns. I'm like, oh, yeah, right.
Whoa, wow.
So she's great for references like that. And
Jill makes all the best pulls. I love it.
She does. So we watched it together as a family and really, really enjoyed it, except for the baby Yoda slapping. No, I can't do it without laughing because it's a puppet, but like they roughed that little dude up.
More than the slapping, I really love the part when the bike trooper played by Adam Pally like pokes at it.
And he gets his finger bitten.
Yeah. I was like, you can't poke a puppet. Anyway.
And Baby Yoda must have sharp teeth because he goes, ouch, even though he's wearing a glove. So.
Oh, it's true. It's true. Mm. And I feel like they made up for it. They like compensated with the extreme cuteness of Baby Yoda on a speeder bike. You know what I mean? Baby Yoda going just like, whoa.
Yeah. In the space Bjorn.
Yeah. I love it. All right. So a few things happened in this episode that we felt like for sure were going to happen this season. Number one, IG-11 sort of comes full circle and, you know, teaches the Mando a lesson about his prejudice towards droids. Number two, Mando gets his mark, the Mudhorn, mark on his armor. Number three, we see Pedro Pascal with the helmet on. And I had a number four, but I don't remember. I'll remember it later. Anyway, so like, you know, a few things that we had expecting would happen. Did those moments hit for you the way that, you know, I'm sure that they were hoping? Like, let's start with like the helmet reveal. Did the helmet reveal hit in a way that you really felt like, okay, this was worth a season of suspense to see who was under that helmet?
Was the fourth thing his name?
Maybe, but I don't know that like, The whole name thing, let's talk about that for a second. The whole name thing is, we didn't know his name all season, but I don't ever remember it being like this big, like, oh my gosh, what's his name sort of thing. Though we do know, and I think it's okay for me to say this, that like, his name did actually leak out at the beginning of the season, via sort of this, behind the scenes interview that Pedro Pascal gave that wasn't supposed to go out that somehow got onto the internet as these things happen. We didn't talk about it just because Lucasfilm didn't really want people to know it.
Well, and out of respect for the fans, I think like, you know, we weren't sure how that was going to play out in the show. And I think it's fair to say like, okay, just because we know something doesn't mean it has to be out there. Let people discover it on their own. I guess it
depends on the thing. I think it matters only because, because we were wondering why it was such a secret because we knew the name and we were like, it's not like he's like, I'm Jyn Skywalker. And you're like, what? You know, it's not, there wasn't like a,
Jyn Palpatine.
Right. A universe significance to this name. But I think there is power in Moff Gideon saying it. And us not having her, you know, like naming the Mandalorian. There is power in that. That's actually maybe my favorite moment of the episode is Moff Gideon, played by Giancarlo Esposito, standing outside and calling out everyone's full name and like, you know, the Cara Dunes from Alderaan, like telling us
Cara
stuff.
Cynthia,
you
know? Dune. I'm like, oh, cool. Cynthia's a Star Wars name now. All right. Is it like spelled like our world? Like,
The disapproving parent who's like, using the middle name. Anyway.
Yes, that's exactly what it was like. Yeah. Cara Cynthia Dune, you get over here just this instant. And, but Din Djarin, like, I think it was fair not to talk about it and not publish anything about it. It leaked out. You didn't know whether, like, episode 5, he was going to meet, like, a Djarin somewhere and that was going to come. You know, you didn't know how it was going to play out. And as it turns out, the name reveal does not illuminate anything about the character necessarily. All we know is that's he has carefully curated this anonymity, and now one of his adversaries has discerned who he is, which means that they know everything about him, because they know the thing that he has worked hardest to keep secret. And so, in a way, it challenges his Mandalorian identity, because that whole thing is about remaining masked and suppressing yourself in favor of the group. And I thought that it worked pretty well as a sort of ominous warning to him. Cara Cynthia Dune, it turns out to be from Alderaan. That was kind of I thought that was a cool reveal.
Yeah.
And then Greef Karga is a disgraced magistrate. So I'm like, okay, that tracks too. Like, I can see him like as kind of a politician who turns to like becoming a crime lord.
But it felt like a very Gus Fring from Breaking Bad thing of like, I've read all of your files. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not just here to blow you up. I've read your complete files. You know what I mean? So
yes, I know everything about you. Yeah, almost ominous and omniscient. So
yeah.
I dug that. Which means, like, he knows things about this child that I think we and they don't yet know. And I'm interested in getting into that in season two.
I have a whole theory about that. I don't know if we want to do that right here. Do you want to hear my whole child Moff Gideon theory?
All right, let's hear it. It's just a theory then, right? It's not something you picked up through your extensive whispering birds.
No. I know nothing about season two except the fact that, here's some things we know. Gina Carano's in it because she said so. So it's not. This was not the last we saw of Kara. That's about it. That's about
Carl
all I know
Weathers
about
is in it. He directs an episode, so we know that.
There you go. That's about it. So here's my theory. We still didn't get like a for sure answer as to why they want the child, what they're extracting from the child, what they're trying to do. Right?
No.
But in the final moments of the episode, we get this reveal that Moff Gideon has this weapon that's known as the Darksaber, which I will talk about in a little bit. But, you know, he basically has a black lightsaber. It's a very storied and significant weapon in Star Wars lore.
It's one of a kind. Because I was like initially like, oh, does he have a black lightsaber or the Darksaber?
And there's only the one.
Yeah, there's only one. So
and I don't know if there's any indication we have that he has the Force himself. And so I'm wondering if this feels like a story I've seen before, and I don't mean that in a bad way, which is here's a guy, maybe he wants to try to make himself a Jedi. You know what I mean? He's got a Jedi's weapon. I mean, it's been wielded by people who aren't Jedi in the past, but like he's got a Jedi's weapon. Maybe he's trying to like pull the Force out of this thing so that he can somehow imbue himself with the Force so that he can be a Jedi.
That tracks.
You know what I mean?
Makes sense. Yeah.
That feels like what his mission is. And I kind of like those stories because it's like a very vulnerable thing to do. You know what I mean? It's like he's very powerful, but he's like, oh, but I want to be a Jedi. And we're all like, we want to be Jedi too. You know,
he's like
it's very
Jafar from Aladdin. Like, yes, you're as powerful as the Sultan, but the genie is more powerful. Like, no, make me a genie.
Exactly.
So
that's my theory. It's not based on anything that I know. It just seems like it's, you know, once I saw the weapon, I was like, oh, that's probably what he wants. So we don't know, but we'll find out. All right. So that's, we'll get back to the Darksaber, I feel like, and I'm sorry, I'm ping-ponging a little, but that's what I tend to do with finales, because it's like, everything, let's go back to the helmet reveal. What did the helmet reveal do for you?
Again, it was him letting down his armor in a literal way, and, having a connection to this droid, and, you know, he says, no living thing has seen my face since I basically joined this creed, the Mandalorian tribe. IG-11 tells him, well, I'm not alive. Which makes the Mandalorian want to push back against that, right? And I think it makes him realize that the droids that killed his family, that it wasn't droids who really wanted that. It was some being that directed them, you know? And that a droid is also capable of kindness if that's what it's taught. And I think there's a whole parenthood theme going through this. We talked a lot about like the stolen children and the absent children, lost children theme that's running through Mandalorian and Star Wars in general. And I thought this was a nice moment It was just nice. It wasn't awe-inspiring. It wasn't, oh my God, that's what he looks like. No, it's like Pedro Pascal looking not his best.
No. <You know? laughs> I mean,
it's kind of like he opened the front face camera and was looking down and he's kind of smushed. And
yeah, not the best, but also like he took it off. I mean, yeah, he's bloody. His hair is damp, blah, blah, not his best. But I was like, I will tell you this much. My helmet hair would have been 1,000 times worse than that if all I ever did was wear a helmet. So, you know. Could have been worse, I think.
Could have been worse, but he didn't look his best, and he got a little back to spray, you know, and that's what it was healing him. And I like the little joke that IG-11 makes, which is like, you've suffered damage to your central processing unit. And he's like, you mean my brain?
My brain.
And he's like, that was a joke. It was meant to put you at ease.
IG-11's trying with a bedside manner. Have we seen back to spray before? Is that a thing?
You can get it at Space Rite Aid. I'm sure it's fine. Like,
okay. Because, like, yeah, so, like, Vader does the, like, back to tank sort of stuff. We've seen Luke in a back to tank. Like, that's a thing. But, like, I was like, oh, it's a spray now?
Okay. I don't know. What's the Harry Potter spell where they just heal each other magically? Like, it's sort of like that.
Yeah.
Back to.
Back to whatever.
Back to Fopendo. Yeah, I don't know.
I guess they're still reserving that, like, big emotional. I mean, I'm assuming. Eventually, we'll see Mandalorian take his helmet off for a person.
Yeah.
And not to discount IG-11, and I think it is important that you're right that, like, that the Mandalorian even hesitated to take his helmet off in front of this droid meant that he was considering this droid as a living thing.
Yeah.
And that's progress for him, so that's important. But it's not a big, like, the big emotional moment that I was waiting for. So maybe we'll still see that when he does it for someone he considers like a fully living thing, mm-hmm. if and when he does that.
Right.
All right. And then he gets his mark, his sigil from the armor, the Mudhorn, the mark that he rejected at the beginning of the season, but now he takes. And I think she says, you're a tribe of two.
Yeah.
This is sort of similar, close to what we were expecting to happen, but how did it land for you?
I don't know. He kind of rejected the Mudhorn, so I know. Now it's a Mudhorn. Like, okay, just okay. I don't know.
Yeah,
it
does look cool.
It did look cool. I didn't quite get it, but you know why it was. It felt underwhelming because he had rejected it before, and it's like, okay, I guess we're just going back to that. But fine,
yeah, it's fine. I agree. Like we were waiting to see some sort of impressionistic version of Baby Yoda. And I get that this creature, like, this is a bonding moment for them. But, yeah, as you say, since he rejected it and then there wasn't a discussion again about it, it was just like on him. And I was like, whoa, okay. Well, there we go.
Yeah.
So that happened. But I will say the armorer, as played by Emily Swallow, had maybe my second favorite moment, which is the armorer's sort of like stand. Where she fights off the stormtroopers. And even though, like, I did not think that they would kill her, because I was like, she's salvaging all that armor. She can't die. She can't die. She's salvaging armor. I just thought she looked so cool with her hammer and tongs and then fighting with them and stuff like that. I thought it was really
hurled
beautiful.
That stormtrooper into the fire pit.
Yes.
That was pretty great.
Yeah. So that was a pretty good moment.
No mercy for stormtroopers in this episode.
No. We see a lot of them go down. Mm-hmm. And then there's this other droid, this like riverboat droid, the ferry droid, that's like kind of looks like R2, but then stands up. I personally, this is my issue, not a issue with the show, found it perturbing to see something that looks so much like R2 with those long legs. It really upset me.
It's funny. I have terrible handwriting and I'm sitting there writing notes. And at the end of the show, like, I leave my notebook down and my wife picks up the notebook and I'm like, can you read any of that? And she looks at it for a long time and she goes, R2-D2 with arms and legs. And I'm like, yes, that is a note I made. Like, it was weird. It was like, I don't know. I guess, but was it bad? It was weird. I think it was meant to be weird. I think
it was like unsettling. I think it was meant to be like a funny reveal, because you're like, oh, that looks like R2. Oh, there's going to be like an R2 droid. And then all of a sudden it's like tall and you're like, whoa, I didn't see that coming.
It was when you're used to seeing him as a little kid and then you see him as a teenager and you're like, oh, I guess you're good at basketball, but you're kind of gangly and weird. You're in that in-between pupa stage. Like, it just didn't seem that. It was because he had like, it wasn't like, I guess it would have been weird if he'd had like really like robust, super battle droid arms and legs. Instead, yeah, it was just like these, it was like spider legs. It was like insect legs coming out of R2. And yeah, that's why it was weird.
It was unsettling for me. The other thing that, we get in this episode is, I think we had already fairly well pieced together the Mandalorian's backstory, because I think because you and I understood that being a Mandalorian wasn't, as Cara Dune says, like, so succinctly, it's not a race. It's a credo, I think they say, or something
it's
like that.
It's a creed. It's not a, it's not a race. It's a creed.
Which is something that I think we struggled to try to really explain to people at the beginning of the season who didn't really understand. But I thought that was a nice, like, succinct way of saying it. But it's like, you don't have to be born a Mandalorian. So I think there's a lot of stuff that, like, if you weren't aware of the Mandalorian culture and all that stuff, this felt like a big reveal that the Mandalorian isn't, like, born Mandalorian, but I think we kind of understood that already. But we saw the flashback in its entirety this time. We see everything that happens, and this time we saw the Mandalorian sort of swoop in and save him. And then there's this other part of the episode that feels kind of weirdly rushed to me, which is, like, the Mandalorian gets his jetpack. And it's like, okay, are you trained? And he's like, yeah. But she's like, okay, but you can't use it yet because you're not really trained yet. So IG-11's going to carry it for you for a while. Oh no, IG-11's dead. You have your pack back. Okay, now you can just use it. Like, I don't know. It just seemed very like, I felt very jerked around by the whole rocket pack thing. I think it would have been better if she had just like given to him and then like he was immediately wearing it versus like this whole rigmarole around it.
I hear what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. And then it all happens so that we can get this mirroring shot of the Mandalorian taking off, with Baby Yoda that mirrors the shot of the Mandalorian soldier who like rescued him as a child from destruction. Mm-hmm. Just to show this, as you say, this idea, this theme of parenting, of cyclical, I don't know, trauma and healing, right?
Yes. I think the whole reason for that you aren't fully trained thing is he does battle with Moff Gideon in his cool folding TIE fighter.
Yeah.
And I think what they wanted to avoid was that he was an expert rocketeer who'd be able to fly like dogfight with the TIE. And he's not capable of that. He essentially vaults up into the air over the TIE, hits it with a grappling hook, and then climbs onto it. He doesn't like soar through the air, you know, like an eagle or something. He's got limited abilities with the rocket pack. So I think that was really all that was setting up. And then he blows up the TIE, which I thought was kind of neat.
Yeah. I mean, it's cool. Like Rocket, like I love the movie, The Rocketeer, and also mm-hmm. the Iron Man franchise. So I love an air fight. I'm here for it. I thought there was like a little extra. It's sort of like, well, not to spoil a moment of The Rise of Skywalker, but I think there is this fear in, House Lucasfilm of fans pushing their glasses up the nose and being like, oh, actually they're not properly trained to this or like something like that.
Boy, you know, he just got the rocket pack and something he can just fly around with it. That's not how this works.
Yeah. It leads to some awkward.
I love how our mean voice, our mean fan voice is like such a snurpus.
So we're headed off to season two with a few things. Number one, Grief and Kara have been left behind, but we know not for long because they're in season two. He's on this mission set to him by the armor to find where Baby Yoda came from. Baby Yoda's people return Baby Yoda to his people. Mm-hmm. And that Moff Gideon is still alive, has the Darksaber, and will not be stopped, apparently. So that's where we're headed in season two, right?
Yes. So what did you think of the Darksaber?
How it looked?
Just its reveal. So Moff Gideon crashes his TIE fighter. He cuts his way out. We think he's dead, but he's not. He cuts his way out, and he cuts his way out with this angled black lightsaber. It looks almost like a cutlass, you know, like a pirate's cutlass. And it's thicker
than like a lightsaber would be.
Yeah, and it has like a curve, like a wider, pointier tip to it. It's not just like a rod. And it he slashes his way out, climbs triumphantly to the top. And I feel like a lot of people are not going to know what this thing is. They're just going to think it's some kind of cool black lightsaber.
But don't worry, because there's a lot of explainer articles out there about what the black lightsaber is, what the dark saber
is. Including at VanityFair.com. Thanks.
Please head to VanityFair.com for the best one written by Anthony Bresnikan. But it's... I only know what it is. I mean, I've seen, you know, it features prominently, pretty prominently in Rebels and, in some of Clone Wars as well. And so I know what it is because I've seen those animated series. We talked before about how, like, seeing the animated series, you know, should not be a barrier of entry for enjoying The Mandalorian. So, I think it's a cool enough, like, it's a cool reveal in terms of, like, that's a cool looking weapon. It's not something we've ever seen before in live action, right? And then for those of us who do know what it is, it's like even more exciting. So I do think it kind of works on both levels. And the fact that he's alive and still out for vengeance is a whole thing. For me, because I do know mostly what the Darksaber is, but I'll sort of have you run it down for me in a second. But like... for me, it was really satisfying because I was waiting. I was waiting for something in this episode that felt like really cool and game changey. And I think that weapon is it. Just for the potential, that I mentioned, even if like my whatever theory isn't true, it's just the potential, the connection to previous Star Wars stories, like all that sort of stuff. And, so I was really excited to see it, but I am curious, you know, if it landed at all for people who don't know what the Darksaber is. And on that note, Anthony, do you want to tell us what the Darksaber is?
I mean, I think it's going to hit people as just like, well, that looks cool. And then they'll maybe go research what it is. And what they're going to find, I suspect in season two is, a little history of it. And that history is that, I mean, there's a long history. I tried to dive into it and write about it yesterday after watching a preview of the episode. And, there's a lot. It was in many episodes of The Clone Wars. It was in many episodes of Rebels. And the upshot is, it's an artifact that's very symbolic to Mandalorians in particular. The first Mandalorian to become a Jedi 1,000 years ago, created this object and, you know, harnesses a different kind of energy with a different kind of crystal, yada, yada, you know, but it doesn't technically function in any way other than a lightsaber, but it has symbolic value to Mandalorians. So the fact that we're in a show called The Mandalorian, I think that has special significance. Another thing I'll note is that it was wielded in the Clone Wars by a character named Pre Vizsla, who was a descendant of that first Mandalorian Jedi, voiced by Jon Favreau, of course, the creator of The Mandalorian, who plays another character earlier in the season called Paz Vizsla, who surely from the same house. It was spelled slightly differently. I don't know if that was like a typo or what, or if that was on purpose, but the Vizslas have a long history in Mandalorian culture. They had the weapon back in the Clone Wars era. And when we see young Din Djarin rescued by Mandalorians in this episode, they have the insignia on their armor of the Shriekhawk, I believe it's called. It has like a more complicated Star Wars name, but it looks like kind of like a flaming phoenix style, rough hewn design. I noticed that on their armor. And of course, that's the House of Vizsla sigil. So the Mandalorian was rescued perhaps by this Pre Vizsla character that Jon Favreau voiced in the animated series, like, or at least by his little team. They called them Yeah. Yeah. So they, well, no, it was like, that was his, during the Clone Wars, he led this little terrorist cell.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, Death, I think it was Death Watch or something. And they, you know, oh, a very upbeat sounding name, you know. they just went with his metal band from high school. Like, let's just name ourselves after that. So the Mandalorian was rescued by these guys. And so that seems to be all tied back into this. So that saber is going to have some symbolic value for the Mandalorian moving forward.
I have some questions about timelines and timing and what we know and whatever, because the armor character, you know, basically the Mandalorian says, right, yeah, I'm protecting this child. He can move things with his mind, you know, because he doesn't, like, really know how to articulate the Force. And then she says, oh, yeah, I've heard tell of something, you know, these Jedi warriors. Now, okay, so we are just a bit past Return of the Jedi, right? Is the timeline we're in. And during the time of Return of the Jedi, like, Obi-Wan's in hiding, Yoda's in hiding, most of the Jedi were exterminated, but Luke sort of rises up. Is it odd that, you know, the Mandalorian doesn't know what Jedi are? Or, I mean, I don't know. How famous is Luke Skywalker at this point? Like, what's going on with the knowledge of the Force? You know, because, like, there, by the time that Luke is, you know, around, like, the Force has passed into legend. And then I'm sorry, I'm all over the place, but here's the last thing I'll say. I guess an explanation for all of this is, like, the universe is large. This universe is large, and so when you've got, like, when The Force Awakens starts, and Finn and Rey are like, oh, the Force isn't a legend, it's real? You know, and Han says, yeah, it's real. I used to think it was mumbo jumbo, but it's not. It's real. I've met Luke Skywalker. And so this idea that the Jedi are so famous to us, but not maybe like believed to be real by everyone in the galaxy is interesting to me, you know?
Yeah, I guess it's a hard thing to wrap your mind around, and it's really kind of for plot convenience,
right,
in a way. So it's one of those things you just have to buy into it or not.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, there doesn't seem to be, like, mass media in the galaxy. Like, there are transmissions and messages you can send, but they're not great. There isn't, like, not everybody knows everything, you know, that there isn't, like, space CNN or something. So
That's my favorite joke out of The Rise of Skywalker. I know we promised not too many Rise of Skywalker spoilers here, but, like, I think you know by now, if you're listening to this, that the Emperor Palpatine is in, he's in the trailers, right? His voice is, at least, is in The Rise of Skywalker, and it's coming around the galaxy in the form of a transmission. And my favorite joke that I've seen, actually from a couple of different places, so I don't know where to source it, is like, oh, everyone's got a podcast. Even the Emperor Palpatine has a podcast. Barring Emperor Palpatine's podcast in The Rise of Skywalker, you're right. There isn't much mass media. So,
Thank you for listening to So Be It, the podcast from Emperor Palpatine.
Who would be his advertisers? Probably not Casper Mattress, but maybe Peloton.
Snuggy. The most,
maybe some sort of like face cream.
The most comfortable robe in the galaxy will enshroud your evil in everlasting comfort.
I'm afraid that's it for this week.
We're this close to starting an Emperor Palpatine podcast.
Is there anything else we want to say about the Mandalorian before we hop over to Rise of Skywalker? And
well, I just think that to just sum up with the what are the Jedi, you know, I think one reason I'm willing to roll with it is the Jedi were very closed off and not keen to explain themselves. So they were kind of like, it's almost like they're like these covert operators. And while they did have a place of prominence in the leadership and protection of the galaxy, a few generations later, they've been exterminated. And I can understand why people would go, yeah, I guess maybe I heard something about that. You know, it just reminds me of a few years ago this is going to be a stupid example, but like, you know, I was watching like a football game over Thanksgiving with like my family, and like a guy came on to perform the halftime show, and they were all like, oh, cool, I love this guy. And I'm like, who is this? They're like, you don't know who Pitbull is? And I was like, no. This was many years ago, but I'm like, no. And then I was like, watched him perform, and I was like, I'm good with not knowing who Pitbull is. Like, there's a reason I don't know this. I don't care. I don't care about him. So I feel like the Jedi are like Pitbull to a lot of people. Like, if you're into that, fine. But if not, if you've got other stuff going on and your people have been wiped out and you're living in a sewer, like, who has time to really know about the Jedi?
Again, all right.
I prefaced it. I told you it was a weird example.
No, I like your weird examples, Anthony, generally. all right. Well, you know, is there anything else you want to say about The Mandalorian before we bid it farewell until season two?
I thought it worked. I thought it was a good show. It had a lot of great moments. It had some interesting story shifts, kind of episode of the week for a little while, and then it brought it back around to something a little more connected. And I'm down for season two. I want to see him find something. I want to find out who he's going to give this kid to.
Yeah, I would like even more connection is something I would love from season two. Mm-hmm. And it could even be even tighter. It probably won't be, but I'm like, I could do with 6 episodes of The Mandalorian. You know, this could have been a 6-episode season as far as I'm concerned. But you know, it might be that next season gets even more in depth, and then I'm like, oh, only 8? What? And one more? So you never know. But I think they're on a good path, and season 2 has a chance to be even stronger.
It's not a show like Game of Thrones where you have like 4 or 5 storylines going at once, and they're kind of weaving together. It's really just the one storyline. So right. You know, there isn't a lot of like, oh, this was a cool like side episode where it focused mainly on this era and this location or this group of people. Like, there's just the Mando and Baby Yoda. So
I want the like Moff Gideon episode that's like just him. Like, yeah. I don't know, reading files, whatever he does in his downtime. I'd love to know about it. All right, so we're gonna hop over to The Rise of Skywalker really quickly first, in case you're not gonna join us for that discussion. I want to say that Still Watching will be back in the new year. Richard will be back on, we actually don't know which show we're doing next yet, so I'm sorry I don't have that to announce for you, but we will be back with more Still Watching something in 2020. But here Anthony and I go with our Rise of Skywalker spoiler heavy thoughts. Leave now or forever hold your peace. Here we go.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then, I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
The dead speak, Anthony. All right. So since we last talked, you and I both, have you seen The Rise of Skywalker one more time or several more times?
Just the one more time.
Yeah, me too. And I went, there's this big theater. I actually wrote a piece about it, when The Force Awakens came out, for Vanity Fair, and because it was supposed to be closing then, and that was supposed to be like the last Star Wars that they showed at that theater. And then, It's still open. But this is a big, we call it the big theater. It's in Marin County where I grew up and where Judge Lucas used, this is the theater he used to screen, movies in for people. There's one out on Skywalker Ranch, but he used to screen movies at this theater, that, you know, the public can go to. And I've seen every Star Wars in, since The Phantom Menace is not that long, but since The Phantom Menace there. And when I did my Force Awakens story, I talked to a bunch of people in line who had seen everything from the beginning there. You know, there was like a tradition for people who lived there. So, I'm glad that it made it to the end of the trilogy. I don't know what's going to happen to that theater, but it was very empty, which is very surprising because usually that theater, when Star Wars is playing, is consistently full. And I think that's kind of telling. Not that this has been like a big box office disappointment. It's just been like slightly muted. And, you know, I think we went midday on a Sunday or something like that, you know, but like it was just not very full. But I had a good time. I just like wanted to have a better time than I did at the premiere. And I did in that, like, I had already done all my like overthinking about it, and then I could just like sort of sit there and like enjoy what I might enjoy from it, if that makes sense. And I still have my issues with it. But you know, mm-hmm. I was also able to enjoy parts of it. So what has been your journey through, The Rise of Skywalker?
It's the reverse of what you just described. Yeah. I feel like when I watched it the first time, I let my emotions get swept up in it and the novelty of it. And then on second viewing, I was a lot more like, wait a minute, like, why is this happening? Like, where I was, the logic flaws stood out to me a lot more, on the second viewing. I still enjoyed it. I definitely understand people's like sense that they didn't get what they wanted from it, you know, or frustration with where the story went that didn't speak to them. The reveal about Rey's origin kind of speaks to me. It does connect with me. So I did find that satisfying. And, mm-hmm. But I also understand why many people don't. But things that bothered me were just sort of, and again, Star Wars is riddled with these, so it's not like a fatal dose of illogic, but things like when Rey sees the transport taking off from Pisana, and she and Kylo engage in what I think of as like force arm wrestling, where they're both trying to, he's trying to push the starship out of the atmosphere and into space. Mm-hmm. She's trying to pull it back, and then she, you know, accidentally lets loose with a bolt of, force lightning that destroys it. And everybody's like, no, Chewie. Oh my God. Chewie died in a fiery ball. Like, it's terrible. And then, like as soon as that happened, I'm like, that's not how Chewie dies. Okay. So that's not gonna, I was like, I literally turned to my wife and said, I think this is going to be like a Marion is in the other basket situation. And like, that's exactly what it was. But what bothered me then was later when they're on the, Kijimi, and she sees the Star Destroyer in the upper atmosphere, and she's like, oh, Chewie's aboard that ship. And I'm like, wait a minute. How can you sense him in a bigger ship that's further away?
Yeah.
But could not sense him in the smaller ship. But now I'm becoming like Patton Oswalt's character from Parks and Recreation. Yeah. Like, I'm pointing at the air. Why could you not do this? Why could you not do that? I guess I just would have preferred for her not to sense Chewie on the ship. You know, I don't know. Why does the force work sometimes and not other times?
I just don't think that they needed to. I think they had two options there. Mm-hmm. Either kill Chewie or don't pretend you killed Chewie.
Yes.
Honestly, because, and I understand that they wanted like her to feel afraid of her power. So there needed to be like a large consequence. And I honestly think they could have, you know, like, that's not how Chewbacca was going to go out in terms of like the last shot we were going to see of him wasn't going to be like from a distance boarding a transporter. But I do think they could have, not that I wanted them to, but I think they could have killed Chewbacca in this one. It's the last one in the trilogy. And if you want to, you know, all the old guard are dying. This makes it sound like I want Chewbacca to die. I didn't, but I'm just saying like either do it or don't, because the fake out death there are multiple fake out deaths in this movie, and that's what really bothers me, right? Because like, you need to have these fake out deaths for the force healing back and forth thing, which ultimately I like the force healing. Kylo's fake out death, and then Rey's fake out death, and Kylo's other fake out death when he goes down the hole, and like, 3PO's sort of fake out death in terms of like, we think his memory's and wife, but oh no, don't worry. Like, R2 is a backup. Like, it just feels like I just felt very jerked around by all of that, you know, in the end. So,
yeah, I'm not a big fan of fake deaths. I wouldn't consider Kylo getting stabbed and healed like a fake death, you know. To me, that's okay.
Yeah, he didn't, he didn't like, go like unconscious.
I would have accepted that and the Rey resurrection at the end.
Yeah.
But you're right, it's one too many. I would have been okay with leaving C-3PO erased. He's been erased before.
And then his like sacrifice means something. It's funny because like, you know, we were talking earlier in this episode about me, like, you know, sometimes I know things that happen, and I knew a lot of what was going to happen in The Rise of Skywalker. Like, so much so that I was looking for that second transport. So I saw it the first time I watched it. I saw the second transport because I knew that that was like a fake out thing that they were going to do. But like, I knew about 3PO's memory wipe, and like, you know, this is something that they sort of like teased in the trailers a lot of like, I want to take one last look at my friends, 3PO said. And so you're just like, you're like, oh, this is a big moment. Except it's not, it's a comedy beat. They play it for comedy. 3PO's memory being wiped is a comedy. It's like the noble sacrifice is not the direction they decided to go with that. And that's fine, but it's just, it feels like cross wiring. You know what I mean? Especially with the way that they sort of played it in the marketing. So I don't know. Maybe that's just expectations versus reality, but, the things that did work for me and still work for me are the performances. Someone was asking me, like, if I thought this movie was better or worse than Solo. Because Solo was a pretty unpopular Star Wars movie. And, I think the performances across the board are just so much stronger and deeper in this movie that I think this movie has to be better for that reason, you know? Not to really knock all the performers in Solo. It's just sort of like, you know, these people were paying off 2, sometimes 5, sometimes, you know, what's math? 8 movies like of lead up to this moment. And so, I think it just has that, it feels weightier that because of that, versus Solo, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things I noticed watching it was how much it's connected to the original trilogy. And, in the Star Wars chronology, the original trilogy is not as far back as like the prequel trilogy, but I think in our chronology, it is. It's much further. It's, you know, it's 42 years ago. And I think some of the dissatisfaction comes from people who are really invested in the new characters. And this movie is quite occupied with connecting them back to things from yesteryear and the past. So for older fans like me who do feel like my strongest connection is through those original characters, Luke Skywalker, Leia, Han Solo, Chewbacca, C-3PO. This movie, it hit a good place, right? It gave me something that was a bit more satisfying. But I think if that's less important to you and you see them more as ornamental to a story about Rey and Finn and Poe and Rose and, you know, Kylo Ren, then I think I understand the frustration that it is so determined to look back to the past and revisit elements from those earlier films. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think for me, I didn't, you know that you and I differ on the Palpatine reveal. For me, it's the big letdown.
Yeah.
I don't remember if it was you or someone was pointing out to me, people who go see it a second time have noticed, and I noticed it my second time, that if you just snip like 5 lines, Rey does not need to be a Palpatine and the story still actually works. She can have like his powers, but not actually literally genetically be a Palpatine. I think that that's fine. But, you know, I see value. You and I have talked about why you responded to Rey as a Palpatine, in terms of like, the idea of coming from, I mean, similar to Luke Skywalker, you know, coming from a ancestry that you're not proud of, or people or parents or grandparents or whatever, that you're like, I don't want to be that. I'm afraid of being that. Let me just try to be me instead, and let me be a good person instead. And I think there is power in that story. It's just unfortunate that it comes, that in telling that story, it buries this other story that Rian Johnson had started to establish, which is like, you cannot know your family. You cannot know them. They can actually be no one, or they can be alcoholics who left you behind or whatever it is, and still be powerful. And I think both of those stories are interesting. I just feel like we've already seen the Palpatine story with Luke and Darth Vader, and a similar story with Luke and Darth Vader, and we hadn't really seen the nobody story. And so that's why it felt like something new, kind of new and cool in Star Wars. And it's not the story that JJ wanted to tell. And, you know, that it's his movie, whatever, he can do what he want. But, that for me continues to be the biggest letdown of Rise of Skywalker, I think.
Yes. And I fully get it. I do. Yeah. I think one of the lines I dislike the most is when, Palpatine and Rey are battling it out, and he's like, I am all the Sith. And that line doesn't bother me, because that seems like, it's one, it seems very childish to me. It's like, I'm rubber, I'm glue, like, you know, whatever you say bounces off me and sticks to you. And then she responds, and I am all the Jedi. And I think she's speaking in terms of, like, I have all of them behind me, you have all of those guys behind you. And now it's like, we're at this focal point. But really, when he says, I am all the Sith, what I wanted her to say was, and I am nobody. Yeah. Nowhere. And like, the idea that he could assemble this cosmic lineage and learn all of these remarkable facts and powers and summon this evil over the eons into his being, like, and basically create this identity for himself. And that she could do the same, but not lose the perspective of where she came from, which is what we always admire about powerful people, right? Like, yeah, he's a zillionaire, or she's a famous actress, or, you know, he's president of the United States, but he hasn't forgotten he's still Jenny from the block, you know? So yeah. I like the idea that she would, you know, they would each have these, the full powers of light and dark on either side, but that she would remember, she would remain humble, and that that would be the thing that overwhelms evil, is that humility and decency and,
yeah,
and I like that. Remembering that she was just Broom Boy, you know.
Well, that, you know, as long as we're getting to like fan fiction rewrite The Rise of Skywalker, I would have preferred if at two things at the very end. Number one, I don't know why Ben isn't there with Luke and Leia on Tatooine. Some people have come up with the idea that he is like inside of her because he has given her his life force. But I read this great tweet that it was that said something like, having, you know, the soul of your like of your ex-boyfriend or whatever, like trapped forever in your body is a horror movie. And I was like,
Yeah,
I hope that's not true. So I would have liked to have had Ben there. And then I also, similar, in a very similar vein, when that woman asks, like, Rey ho, or whatever, I would have liked her to say, just Rey. And like, that's enough. Just Rey. Rey Skywalker. I don't like that. It doesn't work for me. So, I don't know.
I like your version of it. I do like the Rey Skywalker bit. I feel like that's like choosing your family, you know? And, but I do like just Rey. That would have been a very powerful thing, because that would have given people what they wanted, right? Is that I think it's not so much that I think people wanted her to inherit her powers from somebody. I honestly don't believe that was the majority of people who wanted to know. Like, I think they just wanted the mystery to be solved in a way that was,
that felt connected.
Let's just say like in a murder mystery, right? Imagine if the end of the murder mystery is, oh, it was none of the assembled family here in Knives Out. it was just this random guy who came in. Like, that wouldn't but be if, but as if, satisfying. It has to be, it would like, be, the killer has to be among the cast, you know?
It would be so unsatisfying like if there isn't, like, another story beat reason for it.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's a story beat reason for Ray to be nobody from nowhere. And I agree with you. If that had happened in Knives Out, I'd be like, I'm sorry, Ryan. I support you in The Last Jedi, but I need my money back for this.
But I feel like that's what... But I do think there's an audience that's like, well, I want, if we're going to create a mystery of who she is, I want who she is to have some thread back to something that I know.
Right. And that's true. And then there were also fans. That's a fandom. And there were also fans who were like, I am really excited that there is something so incredibly fresh and new.
Yes.
Coming from Star Wars after all these years.
So I think the unity point is that she finds out, oh, I have this awful lineage. Not only am I nobody, which is disappointing, but I'm somebody terrible. Like, I was hoping I was Obi-Wan Kenobi's granddaughter, but instead I'm this this disgusting tyrant's granddaughter. Like, oh, this is the only thing worse. And I think this was JJ's thinking, was this is worse than being nobody. But then at the end, if she had said, I'm just Rey, that would have given people who wanted her just to be nobody that satisfaction of she just decided she's her own self, her own person, and not.
And that's enough.
Yeah.
It's interesting. So another thing that we've learned since, every time one of these Star Wars films comes out, Lucasfilm puts out this thing called the Visual Dictionary, which has a lot of supplemental material in it, written by Pablo Hidalgo of the Story Group. And there's just like a lot of fun descriptions of like plot, props and blah, blah, blah. But there is, a huge plot point that's in this book, because I believe this book was printed before they had done their final cut on the movie, which is, and cause I had heard about this idea that like, this new character played by Naomi Aki, Janna, was Lando's daughter, that Lando stayed on Pasaana because his daughter got taken, by the First Order, and he was looking for her, and that's why he stayed on Pasaana. That was a story, that was a plot line that I had heard about. And so when I saw the final product and that wasn't in there, except for that very odd, I think, moment at the end of the film.
Where it's like, oh, you want to find out who you are? Like, let's go together.
Seems like odd. Kind of flirty. It's weird, without the rest of it. Then it's just like, okay, they looked at their movie. They felt like they didn't have room for the storyline. So they cut it out. But it's in the visual dictionary confirmed that she is Lando's daughter. And so that's a weird quirk of like, we finished the book before the movie sort of.
Wait,
thing,
is it confirmed,
know?
Or does it merely say he has a missing daughter and people are making that connection? The book doesn't say she is explicitly his daughter, right?
Okay. I don't have it in front of me, so I don't know. But let's just say, it tips its hand more in that direction,
yes.
I guess. Sure. Okay.
Yeah.
Sure.
I think. But I'm wrong. I thought there were a number of things in this movie like that. That was just cut out. And so you can take it or leave it. But unresolved things like Finn having something to tell her and then not getting to it, I just don't understand that. I don't understand why that's in the movie if it's not going to be paid off.
Right. And apparently I think JJ implied or whatever, that what he wanted to tell her was that he was force sensitive, not that he loved her or whatever. And it is interesting to start that and not finish it. I don't know. It felt like the thing that I've heard even from people who really love The Rise of Skywalker is that it just felt like there was too much movie in this movie. And it's amazing, like, realizing how much, they had to cut out to even get to this point of too much movie in the movie. So that's, and I have a lot of sympathy for them because, there were a lot of things that, they were grappling with. Number one, Carrie Fisher passed away. That changed, a lot of things. Number two, Colin Trevorrow was let go. That changed a lot of things, and that they never moved their release date despite those things happening. And so they had to scramble. And I think what we're seeing is unfortunately the result of a scramble, to land this. So, there's plenty of people who love the movie. So, it worked for plenty of people. And maybe there are people who want something else from Star Wars. But I think I'm fine. What I'm seeing is the reverse of The Last Jedi. With The Last Jedi, I saw that, the more people watched it, the more they liked it. And what I'm seeing with Rise of Skywalker is the more people watch it, the more they dislike it. So, you know, who knows? But I'm glad. I do want to say something really positive about the fandom right now. Which is, I'm sure you've seen this story that there were a number of people who were upset about what happened, in the end to Adam Driver's character, Kylo Ren / Ben Solo. And these are they're known as the Raylos, the Raylo fans. I thought he got a really nice ending. I like the redemption. I like the sacrifice. I like the Vader parallel. It all works for me. But there's a lot of people who wanted him to do I do think it's odd that he has no lines really as Ben Solo. I think that that's odd. If we're fanficking once again, I would have given him and Rey like a scene with dialogue at the very end there, because Adam Driver and Daisy Ridley are so good. And, you know, a very give them a Vader and Luke scene, you know, give them that. That would have made me really happy. But, for the fans who were unhappy, they have channeled their frustration into a GoFundMe for Adam Driver's charity, this charity that he founded, which is, not charity, maybe nonprofit, called Arts, I believe it's called Arts in the Armed Forces. I might have that incorrect, but, and have raised at this point, I think it's close to $40,000, maybe more, for that. And that funds the program for an entire year. Bringing the performing arts, you know, cause Adam Driver, himself was in the armed forces. So bringing the performing arts to the armed forces. And I just think that that is a really cool and positive thing for a fandom to do with their frustration. You know what I mean? Is instead of channeling it into online toxicity, they funneled it into this fundraiser. And I think that that's a really, really cool thing. And I wanted to shout it out. So
yeah, that is. So how would people find that? By searching GoFundMe and...
Yeah, let me find the exact thing so I can, which I should have had ready so that I can direct people if they too want to donate. Yeah, but...
We'll hit it at the end as we wrap up. We'll give then you have time to find it.
Sure. What else do you want? Is there anything else you want to say about Rise of Skywalker?
I just think he had to die. I'm sorry, Raylos. There's no happily ever after for somebody who commits the crimes and wrongs and mass murder that Kylo Ren committed. I think forgiveness is possible and maybe a bit of redemption, but there's no welcoming him back to Resistance base camp and partying with him with all the other aliens and puppets. It's just not going
to
happen.
I mean, I think if you try to think of, I think what the people who are hoping, you know, I don't know, he and Rey live happily ever after on a moisture farm on Tatooine or whatever. I think the way that they were rationalizing it was to try to make in their minds Ben Solo and Kylo Ren be two different people. Sort of like Ben Solo falls and everything that he did. It's like being in a fugue state. Everything he does is Kylo Ren doesn't count. You know, and I think people think of Anakin Skywalker and Darth Vader as the same thing, two different people. But Anakin Skywalker had to die for his sins, and I think Ben Solo probably did too, you know. I don't read the extended, I don't read the comics and stuff like that, but I know that there's been a lot of, or at least some stuff about Ben Solo's upbringing in there and some of the abuse that he suffered at the hands of Snoke and all this sort of stuff, which makes him an even more sympathetic character for people who've been who've gone really deep on his story outside of the films. So I kind of I have sympathy for that point of view. I just think it is very narratively satisfying in an echoey sort of way for him to die. I think he could have been given one more scene feel whole. One more scene, you know. I don't know.
I agree. Yeah.
Anything else we want to talk about? I don't know.
I think that kind of covers it.
All right. So that's our spoilery Rise of Skywalker thoughts. Some complaints. Some things. I'm trying to think if there's anything I feel even more positive about after the second time.
Here's something I noticed the second time went past me the first time. There's a lot of talk about Rian Johnson democratizing the Force and Broom Boy and the idea that the the Force is speaking to a lot of people, not just descendants of the famous Force wielders. And that is in the movie. It's subtle, perhaps more subtle than people would have wanted, but it's in the conversation between Finn and Janna when they talk about leaving and pushing away as former stormtroopers and going AWOL and becoming resistance to the First Order. She talks about like a feeling, and he's like, yes, like an instinct. Like, and they have this bonding moment over the Force reaching out to them and connecting with them. And I like that idea a lot. I feel like that carries on a thread that Ryan established. It also connects back to something that JJ established with the Force Awakening. What did that mean? Where did it awaken? And the idea that it awakened in ordinary people who did not feel it before is refreshing. And I think it also, again, it doesn't dwell on it. It doesn't take this ball and run really far with it, but it does suggest that those people who helped take down the Star Destroyers in this movie, those former stormtroopers rebelling against their kidnappers, are connected to the Force and may not be Jedi powered. You know, they may not be launching Force lightning or Force healing or Force whatever, but they do have a sort of connection to this invisible cosmic power. And I really liked that. So I did think that was in there. Again, not as pronounced, perhaps, but still there.
Yeah, I think, I think this idea of making Finn Force sensitive, and I see what they were going for there. And they were trying to make a bunch of people happy. And I think what I feel about this movie, and it's something that Richard articulated in his review was a bit more brutal than how I feel about The Rise of Skywalker, but something he articulated was that this film feels so desperate to be liked, so desperate to try to appease everyone on both sides, that it just gets lost in the jumble of that. Mm-hmm. And that's how I feel about almost every decision. I'm like, okay, trying to make Finn Force sensitive will hopefully make the people who were upset that Finn was not a Jedi, even though he was holding the lightsaber on the poster and in the trailers for The Force Awakens, maybe it'll make them happy, and it'll make John Boyega happy because John Boyega was mad about being sidelined in the last movie, and maybe it'll make these people happy. And I'm like, yeah, but it's kind of half measured because it's there, but it's not, you don't like tie it up with anything. It's just kind of there in a way. Yeah. And that's how I feel about a lot of decisions where it's like, you know, if I can feel them, you know, okay, Rose is technically in this movie. So if you liked Rose, you can't be mad. We didn't cut her out of the movie entirely, but we did everything but cut her out of the entire movie, you know? So like maybe people who hate Rose are mad, are appeased by that. And instead, you know, like, they, I feel that way about the gay kiss. The gay kiss feels just like a half measure. Like, there's just all this stuff that just feels like, I wish they had been bolder with it, you know?
Be bolder is a good guideline. Like, there's not enough just to say, okay, tag. I've tagged that.
Right.
I've tagged that. I've checked that box and moved on. Like, it's not enough just to say, okay, we covered that. You do have to, sometimes you do have to dwell on it, and you can't dwell on everything. So choices are important. It's very difficult to make these movies that appeal to everyone, and I don't think that's possible.
Right.
But I do think you can please, you have to just choose which audience you're playing to.
Absolutely. I think that's right. I think you have to just reconcile the fact that you're not going to please every single person. So just really lean into the story that you want to tell.
Yeah.
And that's a success. You see that success with something like, I think Mad Max, Fury Road is a good example of that, where that just feels like, I know that there were people who did not like those movies, but I think that movie was not at all concerned with trying to be liked. It was just trying to be like very bold. And I think it was, and I think it works. So, you know. It's, I don't know why that example came to me. All right. Is there anything else we want to say on this? My last podcast of 2019.
I think that covers it.
All right. So that
we have spoken.
That GoFundMe I mentioned is called The Rise of Ben Solo. Actually, the image that they're using is the Annie Leibovitz Vanity Fair cover with Adam Driver. They've raised $46,000. That's well over their goal of $32,000. But if you too would like to donate to arts in the armed forces, you can do that now over at the Rise of Bensoul GoFundMe. So I think it's a good cause in general, but I just like to see fandoms doing good things when there was just so much fighting around The Last Jedi, and there's still so much fighting around this movie, and I'm just like, oh, but isn't it great when, like, what did you see that other Star Wars heartwarming Star Wars fandom story about that I learned about on TikTok about that young man? So a young man who was a huge Star Wars fan, who died earlier this year after stopping the shooter at University of North Carolina in Charlotte, was given a name. His name's Riley Howell, and Lucasfilm opted to name a character. Riley, it's spelled a little different than his given name, Howell, a Jedi Master.
It's R-I-L-E-E. Give it a little cosmic twist there. But Howell, Riley Howell, Jedi Master and historian.
Yeah. And that's just like, that's Star Wars at its greatest. I love that. I love that. You know, this is a tremendously tragic and upsetting story. And that Lucasfilm, like, did this beautiful thing around it is like that's what I want to love and want to, like, be excited about, and that's maybe what, you know, we can see even more of in the future for Lucasfilm and for their properties.
Yeah, 21-year-old guy, he rushed the UNC shooter. Riley had his whole life ahead of him, and he sacrificed it for other people's lives, and that's something that deserves to be remembered, and hopefully, you know, we can all pray that we don't have to rush out into the line of fire when somebody opens fire in a store or a school or a church or wherever we happen to be. And in addition to being heartwarming, I hope it's something that makes people say, this really, we don't really have to live this way, and maybe we'll eventually get some change in the way our country operates and thinks about guns and how just about anybody can get one at any time. And, you know, he's a really admirable young man, Riley Howell, and he lives on in the galaxy.
I think Riley and his story is a great way to wrap up 2019 and think about 2020 and 2020 and all the things that we might accomplish next year. And so, Anthony, until next year, where can folks find you?
They can find me on Twitter at PressNickCam.
You can find me on Twitter at JoeWroteThis. You can find both of us on VanityFair.com. And we will see you in 2020.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.